Welcome back to We Love Movies. Now, with Dublin Old School out in cinemas, we thought we would take a look at films that may have inspired the film, other dance movies. Joining me is Andy McCarroll, one of which, Andy, from the late 90s, is Human Traffic. I have a real soft spot for Human Traffic, Andy. Tell us a little bit about this film for those that haven't seen it.
Yeah, this is a film, John Sim. Some people might remember him from Life on Mars. It's him and his four best mates, one of whom is Danny Dyer, of all people. And the whole thing kind of takes place over one night of partying in Cardiff. You know, there's drink, there's drugs, there's, you know, friendships coming together, romance is starting. It's just absolutely, it's very much of its time and very much inspired by the kind of, you know, that whole Cool Britannia movement that Trainspotting started. The soundtrack is absolutely fantastic. Yeah, people like Carl Cox, Fatboy Slim, Orbital, this, you know, everyone that was kind of, you know, cool dancing in the 90s are on it. And it's, like you said, it's one of those films that if you've seen it at the time, you'll definitely have a real soft spot for.
Yeah, here's a little bit from it.
Hello.
Hey, how's it going, you big cockney space case?
Shut it.
Listen, did you manage to shift that ticket for tonight's spiritual gathering?
Ah, mate, nah, not at all, nah.
Oh, nice one!
Why, who needs one?
Lulu.
Oh, sweet.
Sweet as, mate.
Cool.
That's you. Oh, for fuck's sake.
I'll catch you later, mate. Don't go changing. Try and please me, all right?
Yeah, nice one, bruv, yeah.
Oh, nice one, brother.
Nice one, brother.
Nice one, brother.
I said, nice, bruv.
Nice one, brother.
I said, nice, bruv.
Fucking nice one, brother.
Nice one, bruv. Brother.
Fuck off.
Andy, I believe there's talk of a Human Traffic too.
Yeah, well, there's already been a remix initially. What happened was the original producer kicked the director off. What was happening is the film became more successful than they'd initially anticipated. We spoke there earlier about the soundtrack. And what happened was if the DVD had hit a certain amount of numbers, all these guys were going to get bonuses. So the director kind of reproduced it with a completely different soundtrack to avoid paying everybody the money. And, you know, it sold the rights to the film, and the director has actually picked up himself and John Sim. I think it was last year, was supposed to start shooting. It's been delayed again, where it's basically the four main characters reunite and have basically one last party in Ibiza. It'd be kind of interesting to see, because this was very much an under-the-radar film. I think it's more kind of people, you know, me and your age now that would remember that. And I don't know if, you know, Human Traffic 2, especially something that's of that time so much, would have a big following now for the sequels to be released. You've seen with, you know, things like Zoolander and Anchorman, which had massive followings. They didn't do very well. You know, is this something that people are clamoring for? I'd certainly be interested to see what they could do with it, especially with if they were to bring all the cast back. But, you know, a film with Danny Dyer now, is it really going to break the box office?
No, I think you'd have to be a real fan of the first film to want to see a second one. And even that title alone, The Four Friends Reuniting in Ibiza, sounds a bit lazy. We'll move on, Andy. 24-Hour Party People. I love this film. I think it's absolutely brilliant. All about good old Tony Wilson and his management style and how he founded the Hacienda. It's a real cracker, and I think it's one of Steve Coogan's best film roles.
Yeah, I think with Alan Partridge, it's kind of easy to forget just what a good actor he is. And I think this story absolutely perfectly suits him as well. Like Peter Hook from New Order described, you know, the film of Tony Wilson played by Steve Coogan as a film about the biggest C word in Manchester played by the second biggest. So you can kind of see what a great mix of the material and the actor that it was. Again, this is one of these, like, the kind of last days of rock and roll stories that you don't really hear about, especially with the British scene. Just, you know, Tony Wilson signing the first contract in blood, of course, the Happy Mondays. Anyone who watched, you know, the Chris Evans show during the 90s, remember Sean Ryder getting banned from Channel 4 for, he was asked not to swear because it was live television. Literally, the first words out of his mouth is F this, F that, and he ended up getting banned from Channel 4 for years. There's this great story as well with the Happy Mondays are given this massive contract to go to Barbados to record the album. The reason before I sending them to Barbados was they didn't think there was any drugs there. Turns out there's some, you know, insane strain of heroin over in Barbados. They record the album, comes back, it's completely instrumental with no words. You know, the most famous frontman in the band, Sean Ryder, not singing a word of it. So, you know, kind of just goes to show that the madness that was going on. It was like the Manchester scene was very aptly named for it.
Oh, it's a great, great film. Well worth a watch if you haven't seen it. Here's a bit from it.
Manchester, birthplace to the railways, the computer, the bouncing bomb. In 1976, if you wanted to see the most exciting bands in the world, they were on a regional show coming out of Manchester. My show. I'm Tony Wilson. June the 4th, the Sex Pistols play Manchester for the very first time. There are only 42 people in the audience. Inspired, they will go out and perform wondrous deeds. For instance, behind me are Stiff Kittens, later to become Joy Division. And finally to become New Order.
And finally, Andy, we're taking a look at films that have inspired Dublin old school, a film which you reckon is the last cultural movement, Trainspotting.
Yeah, I really feel like this is the last kind of, like, it kicked off, we spoke earlier about the kind of the cool Britannia movement with, you know, Oasis, Blur, you know, the Verb, Euro 96, that whole kind of movement there. You had Trainspotting, which was this touchstone point in cinema that just ignited like every film for the next 5 years. You know, you'd go, you know, obviously 24 Hour Party People, Fear and Loathing, anything like that was kind of inspired by that, trying to cling on to it. The soundtrack was number one. It made superstars of Ewan McGregor, Danny Boyle. Like, this was the last one that I feel like everyone had, you know, the Trainspotting poster on the wall. Everyone was listening to the soundtrack. And it really, it grew and grew. And I think because you're getting, you know, you see now you've got a different superhero film in the cinema every couple of weeks. There's no time for films to build an audience the way Trainspotting did. And you don't really have those types of films that, you know, you have to go and see. Like, the reason you're kind of, you have to see this film so, like, the end doesn't get spoiled or a twist doesn't get spoiled. This was something that was a real discussion point because of the story, because of the actors, because the characters you could relate to in the film. And I don't think we've kind of had that since Trainspotting. Obviously, there's been brilliant films since then, but I don't think you've had something that really tapped into the consciousness of the public since this film.
And why do you think the sequel didn't work, Andy?
I think the problem with that is because it was very much of its time. Like, that was, like, Trainspotting was this movement of, you know, the 90s and everything that was associated with that, you know, we spoke of the music and things like that. And I don't think setting everything that you had then now is going to reignite. It's going to just be nostalgia as opposed to starting something new. Like, the reason this done so well is because it was so bold. Like, there's that kind of, you know, the iconic poster and the tagline above it of Hollywood, come in, your time is up. Like, it felt like it was something edgy and cool that you hadn't really seen before, that it felt kind of, you know, dangerous to watch, essentially. And I don't think having them all come back when, you know, they're mid-40s and 50s and clamoring for the good old days is going to have that same resonance with it that it did during your kind of, you know, like, I was quite young watching it growing up, so it was a real influence on me then, that it doesn't really have that effect on you now if you watch it, you know, 20 years later.
Well, Andy, listen, thank you so much for going through all of those films. Just to quickly backtrack, we had Human Traffic in there, 24 Hour Party People, and of course, from 1996, Trainspotting. Here is just a little bit from it. Andy, thanks again.
Cheers. Thanks, Gordon.
What is the point you're trying to make?
All I am trying to do, Mark, is to help you understand that The Name of the Rose is merely a blip on an otherwise uninterrupted downward trajectory.
And what about The Untouchables?
I don't rate that at all.
Despite the Academy Award?
That means fuck all. It's a sympathy vote.
So, we all get old, we can't hack it anymore, and that's it.
Yeah.
We love movies with Gordon Hayden.
Now, out in cinemas this weekend is Kevin MacDonald's new documentary. It is called Whitney, which is all about the true story behind Whitney Houston and some of the dark secrets that went on in her life, and one in particular that she took to the grave that is uncovered in this film. Before we speak to Chris Wasser from The Herald about what he thought of this new film, here's a little bit from the trailer to Whitney.
What does she mean to you?
She's the greatest female entertainer of the 20th century.
So much soul and so much spirit.
There was Lena Horne, there's Dionne Warwick, but if the mantle is to pass to somebody who's got an incredible range of talent, but guts and soul, it will be Whitney Houston, in my opinion. Share.
Nobody could touch Whitney as far as singing. They said, Mom, she taught Whitney everything she knew about how to use that voice.
You had three places to sing from.
Heart, mind, guts. She learned them all.
Joining me now is Chris Wasser from the Herald to review Whitney. Chris, we've got a very credible filmmaker in Kevin MacDonald at the helm here, and we had him on Wheel of Movies a little later on, and he said he wasn't initially interested in Whitney Houston's story. He wasn't a massive fan, but it was only through talking to the family and other people close to her that he felt almost he was like a detective just uncovering certain aspects of her life. From what we've seen before of Whitney Houston, other documentaries like Nick Broomfield's and other ones that have been made, how does this one differ?
Yeah, I think you hit the nail on the head there with Kevin MacDonald probably feeling like a detective when he started filming this and, you know, putting in the research, because it's, you know, it's very difficult not to put it up against Whitney, Can I Be Me, but we have to do it. Why? Because Nick Broomfield's film, Whitney, Can I Be Me, it was released just 13 months ago. So some people might be thinking, hold on, haven't we seen this documentary? But with Nick Broomfield's efforts, I think that largely focused on the 2008-2009 tour that Whitney Houston set off on. And, you know, it also looked at two or three kind of unanswered questions and regarding her personal life. But with Kevin MacDonald's film, I'm not sure whether it was the fact that Kevin MacDonald already had, you know, established himself as you know, a very good documentary and a very good feature filmmaker, that Whitney Houston's family agreed to both participate and, you know, be filmed for this documentary. It seems as though they kind of, you know, said, look, we'll give you what you want to an extent, and we'll also allow you to interview us, to ask us the questions. So this is certainly a more intricate and intimate offering than Nick Broomfield's, which was acclaimed, which was a noble effort, but this is something else entirely. It's a more comprehensive look at the life and career of the late, great Whitney Houston. And before we get to maybe the serious side, you know, because this, you know, MacDonald here, he digs deep and he does, you know, it's a respectful eye, but he's still casting an investigative eye over Houston's career. But some of the lighter moments in this film, I thought, were just beautiful as well. You know, there, it takes a look at, you know, Whitney Houston discovering and honing her talents and just that remarkable voice. It takes a look at, you know, those record-breaking first two albums. I think the second album, you know, 20 million units shifted, still one of the, if not the highest-selling second album by a female artist in history. And also the impact of The Bodyguard. I mean, there is a lovely moment in this film where you're shown just how much of an impact that film, and indeed the theme from us, the famous Dolly Parton cover, you know, how much of an impact that made on international audiences. I love the fact that I think one woman in England was imprisoned for a week. You know, her noise pollution, was it? Her neighbours complained about her playing the song too much.
That's so true. That's such a lovely moment as well. And that just goes to show you just how painstaking it must have been for Kevin MacDonald as a filmmaker, going through so much footage and audio to craft this tale. Let's talk about some of the main players that he manages to get on camera, because we have Sissy, her mother, who was a highly regarded backing singer. Unfortunately, she never really made it as a solo artist in her own right, but she did work with some of the biggest names in the business, like Elvis, for example. She also had a father who was a civil servant, but he was a man who definitely was sort of rising up the ranks, but he was doing it with some ulterior motives behind the scenes.
Yes.
Like, let's just say he wouldn't be shy of a brown envelope when it came to planning authorities and all that. And then we have her brothers, the, you know, who were very close to her, but yet they struggled with addiction problems. And of course, we've got Bobby Brown there, the husband, who a lot of people could look at as a major downfall in her life. And then there's possibly the person who you might consider to be the love of her life to a degree, was Robin Crawford, her childhood friend. Tell us a little bit about some of those players in the documentary, Chris, and how they fare.
Well, I mean, the thing we have to remember is that Whitney Houston was something of a meal ticket for various family members. And the difference with having family members and collaborators and friends participate in a documentary about a late music star, you know, sometimes, you know, you'll get 2 hours of everyone saying how great they were, or, you know, talking about the troubles or whatever it was, but that they were always on the outside a little bit more. The difference here is that everyone was either working for her or, you know, pushing her. You know, you had her mother pushing her very, very hard because she knew that her daughter had this talent. But then it almost seems as though now that her mother is, I don't know, maybe just there's a
spark of jealousy there, that, you know, she had the career that she had wanted for herself. You know, she was a backing singer for most of her life, and Whitney Houston just went on to become a superstar. That must be kind of difficult. You know, you'd be proud, but you're also kind of wondering, wish that was me. Her brothers then, you know, she basically gave family members jobs, even though, you know, they were on the Whitney Houston payroll, but nobody really knew what they were supposed to be doing. They were getting paid to just kind of be there on tour, whether it was maybe they might be security, they might be just there to look after it, but they were getting paid. And then her father was effectively, let's just say that her family did not handle her fortune very well, and that a lot of money was either squandered or just completely disappeared, which was a big problem later on in life when it came to Houston having to do a tour just to make some money back. So things do get very detailed, and of course you can't leave out Robin Crawford, who I don't think has agreed to participate in any documentaries.
That's right. About
Whitney Houston. She preferred to keep things private. So there are always going to be unanswered questions there, but it seems to be that she was more than just a friend. She was more than just a personal assistant. And Kevin McDonald, he asks, here's the difference again. This is what documentary making is supposed to do. It asks serious questions. And though the brothers, for example, or even Bobby Brown, Houston's former husband, sometimes they don't want to be asked the hard questions. And McDonald has decided to keep the footage where they're saying, I don't want to talk about that. But he will eventually get them talking about the things you don't want to talk about, which is, you know, the mishandling of the fortune, Robin Crawford, the fact that, she suffered, she battled these harrowing drug addictions towards the end of her life. And curiously, again, doing something that a documentary is supposed to do, it offers up new information that is just astonishing, in that, two family members make allegations against the singer Dee Dee Warwick, who was Whitney Houston's cousin, and they are effectively saying that Dee Dee Warwick, abused Whitney Houston and another family member when they were just children. And I know that this film has already gotten people talking, again, which is what a documentary is supposed to do, but I was just dumbfounded by that. I had never heard that before. So it already is controversial. So things do get rather serious. Bobby Brown, I don't know about you, Gordon, but I came away just thinking, well, that guy continues to be a so-and-so. It was just a destructive relationship. You know, there might have been a time where there was an attraction, there was love there, but they were just no good for each other.
No, and he really is the bottom of the barrel. He is just, there's nothing redeeming whatsoever you can say about that man, and this film just completely holds a mirror up to the guy, and he's completely deluded. And actually I would say quite a narcissistic character as well. Chris, we could spend so much more going into this film and probing a bit more, but fortunately time is up against us. But you did a great job going through as much as we could within the short time. So out of 10, what would you give Whitney?
I just think it is a fabulous documentary. It's uncomfortable to watch at times because you will be asking yourself the question, do I need to know this? Is this not private? But as far as a documentary on a music icon goes, it's up there with the best. It's bold, it's personal, and it's revealing, and it's very, very well edited and assembled. So I'm going to go with... We'll go with 8 out of 10.
8 out of 10. I loved it, I have to say, Chris. I just felt it is, without doubt, my film of the year so far. I just really...
Okay.
I was really blown away with it now. And we've had some really good documentaries so far. Like, a few weeks ago, we were reviewing McQueen, which we both thoroughly enjoyed. But this one really struck a chord with me, I have to say. Chris Wasser, always a pleasure speaking to you. That is Chris Wasser from The Herald. And that is our lot on We Love Movies for this week. But on next week's show, Incredibles 2 is out, and we will be reviewing that. For me, Gordon Hayden, and the rest of the We Love Movies team, enjoy the rest of your Sunday.